You are now listening to the Serious Growth Podcast with your host, Leo Costa Jr.
Hey, this is Leo Costa coming to you from SeriousGrowth.com. On today's show, we have Dr. Ian Reynolds. Ian, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
I know at the top of the show, you just told me you just got done with some surgeries today, so I really do appreciate you coming on. I know you're really busy. I noticed that your specialty is in orthopedics with emphasis on spinal surgery, arthroscopic surgery, and total joint replacement. And my question is, what got you or made you choose this specialty?
Well, basically, when I got done with my internship, and in the days that I did it, we had to do an internship and either pick surgery or medicine. I did my own surgery, and we had various rotations that we had to do in of the surgical specialties. I really couldn't decide what I wanted to do. So I went in the emergency room business. I did emergency room for a couple of years in the New Orleans area, various emergency rooms. I got to be really good at treating endemic heart disease, heart attacks and young people and all kinds of crazy things like that. But when somebody came in with a broken leg or a broken wrist, I thought, what am I going to do with this? I mean, how do I fix this? How do I make it better? And other than just putting in a splint and hoping for the best. So I said, well, this is something I need to learn. So I went down to the medical center in New Orleans at Ochsner and talked to the chairman. And he says, well, okay, well, come back in 3 months. So I came back in 3 months and he says, well, I got a spot for you if you want it. So I said, great. So that's how I got started.
Oh, okay. So obviously you fell in love with that side of it. So how much, you know, as an athlete, I came through football. I played football the longest in my career. And one thing that I noticed that really changed the game, as far as I could tell, was how quickly athletes got back on the field from a knee injury, for example. So how much did arthroscopic surgery really change the game, whether it be with athletes or the average, you know, the population? How much did that change the game?
I think it helped tremendously. I mean, it was arthroscopy when I was going through residency was just getting started. I mean, we were doing things looking through our arthroscopes, but we didn't have cameras in those days. We had to actually put our eye down to the edge of the scope and look in the joint. And then what we would still do sometimes is make an incision and open up the joint and fix whatever needed to be fixed. But, you know, a lot of that's changed now. We have instruments that we can do that. We can operate through a couple of little holes in the joint. And if somebody has a torn meniscus or something that was, you know, disrupted during, an event that's minor, we can get them back full speed within a minimum of 6 weeks most of the time.
Yeah. Actually, I remember maybe this guy, we had a crazy linebacker when I played college football. And I distinctly remember that guy having a surgery after a game or something like that. And he was back the next week. I mean, maybe it's just to the degree of the injury, but it was incredible how quick it could have been 2 weeks. But the point is, he came back pretty immediate, you know. So I'm assuming that a lot of the part of the reason why the athletes come back faster, maybe you agree or you don't agree, but it has to do with it's not so, that putting that big scar on the leg was pretty aggressive. And that wasn't that just part of the reason why people didn't recover quicker? It was just because of the actual
Sure. When you cut open the knee joint, you make a big scar on it, that really causes, really slows you down a lot. All that has to heal back up.
Right.
In a lot of cases, you'll get atrophy of your quadriceps, your vastus medialis, within a couple of weeks after that. And then you've got to spend time rebuilding that muscle.
Right.
Whereas if, you have today's athletes, I mean, they're well-developed, well-trained, and it's a minor thing for them to have an arthroscopic surgery. They don't lose their muscle as rapidly after an arthrotomy, which is to cut open the knee joint.
Yeah.
They don't lose it. And excuse me a second. Let me just put this in. Let me call you later. Okay. So they get better quicker.
Yeah, no, I saw that firsthand. I couldn't believe it. So the surgeries that you do, is it, do you specialize with athletes, or is it just general population, or do you do many athletes? I guess is what I'm asking.
I have done some athletes in the past. Depends on, you know, who comes in the door a lot of times, but I have a, you know, I take care of all kinds of people, not just athletes. I've done, you know, a champion kickboxers. I've done people that have been in some MMA fighters, some people with water ski champions, different things like that.
Yeah.
Not in general. It's just general population.
Yeah, just what comes across. So what do you think, in your opinion, what's the most dangerous sport?
Most dangerous sport for injuries?
Yeah.
Well, it depends on, I guess, what country you're talking about, but I imagine rugby probably would be.
How about football, basketball, you know, the general sports in our country?
Football.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then what is in football, what have you seen as the main injury in that sport?
Main injury, I think, you know, was obviously the big problem was clipping injuries. You know, getting hit from behind and tear of the medial meniscus.
Yeah.
And anterior cruciate, that's called the terrible triad.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's sometimes the beginning and the end of the knee when you have to fix those.
Oh, yeah. And they still are. I mean, it's a lot better now with some of the rules. And then they have like a lot of the athletes now, especially the linemen, are all wearing those knee braces. But all the time you see them getting rolled up on, you know, and it's amazing that more of that stuff doesn't actually happen.
Right, sure.
What about like the, for football, what about the back? I noticed that the offensive linemen, the way that they block and have to block, it almost seems like their back is like arched in a way that over time that you would see a lot of back injuries with them.
Those people tend to have, they reach up to block when they come off the line. A lot of those guys end up getting what's called pars fractures. They get a slippage after they get a stress fracture in the area between the facet joints at L5-S1, the very bottom of the spine. And that can eventually then lead to degeneration of the facet joint and or the disc at L5-S1. Then you get a slippage. The whole bone above your sacrum tends to slide forward a little bit, and that puts pressure on nerves.
Yeah, and I would imagine that, I mean, back in when I was playing ball, lineman that was, you know, 250, 225 to 250, 275, some of these guys now are up 300 and 350 pounds. That's got to make it even worse, doesn't it? All that weight.
I'm sure it does. I mean, it's all, well, they've got bigger muscles. They put more muscle on there. It's more stress. Their bones, if they do something for a long, long period of time, then their bone will compensate for it. It'll get bigger over time. But basically, when you're being trained for a certain position, you're putting more muscle on it, and you're going to put more strain on it, and the bone may not be able to take it.
Right. Yeah, those guys are, well, they're freaks anyway. For some of those guys to be as big as they are, and to run like they do, I'm just amazed at simply them doing that. I mean, I saw a lineman the other day when I was watching a game, and I couldn't believe how fast that guy was getting downfield. He went to tackle to somebody, and I thought, this had to be a linebacker. Hell no, it was a damn lineman, you know, big old 350-pound lineman. Yeah, they're amazing. How about, as a trainer, I've trained a lot of people over the years, and I really kind of, again, I'm like you. I take on anybody that comes, sees us at our facility. But I spend a lot of time in learning how to train athletes. So to develop sports-specific training for the different sports, any kind of sport. And one of the sports that I found to be really rough on the low back, especially, is golf. Have you dealt with golfers?
I have. Golfers, probably about 50% of golfers have back problems, injuries. Yeah. And that's because of the torque that they put on their spine. And it's a twisting injury. Sometimes if their form is not correct, they will they will have a little bit of flexion associated with it. And it's the flexion and the twisting that causes the disc to herniate. So the fibers in the posterior aspect of the disc are like this. Mm-hmm. So when you're twisting and you're flexing, those things tend to, they tend to unwind. Actually, they're like this, I'm saying. They're like that to start with. But when you twist and flex, they open up like that, those fibers, in them, and there's a weak spot there. Yeah. And then you can herniate a disc.
Don't you think that that movement is unnatural and it's a violent move?
It is. It's unnatural.
And I guess that, like, your, you know, your natural physiology is designed to adapt to an environment. And I guess that I think a lot of the problems, even what I've seen with, especially in sport, is because it's, you know, there's so much repetition that it becomes overuse. And if you don't know how to begin with, not to overtrain the body, then the, I mean, the recovery from that is brutal. And sometimes you're just so overtrained that a lot of these guys play hurt, you know, throughout a season. You know, I think it's a lot of it has to do with just so much. It's just overtrained all the time, you know. Do you agree with that?
I agree, absolutely. I think it's sometimes it's just too much.
Yep, just too much. I know. I guess, but that's the nature of the beast. And, you know, it's gotten so damn competitive. It seems like now that you know, they start earlier and earlier, and it's a, these guys don't last as long as maybe they should. In terms of kids, do you think the kids are starting tackle football too soon?
I don't think it's been any different. You know, it's just the nature of the game and the competition. I think it's it hadn't changed in years, I don't think.
Yeah, and I always thought that, you know, it's kind of relative. I mean, you know, people worry about the kids like it, I forget how young they start. But it seems like, you know, they weren't running as fast, and it was all relative. They didn't really make contact like the people who are older do. So I never thought it was that big of a deal. But what I did notice was where the danger was the coaches that were weekend warrior coaches and not knowing how to teach technique. That's where I saw, like, a lot of the problem was, especially with the younger kids, like in Pop Warner. You know,
coaches. Well, some of them aren't professionals, you know. That's where, you know, some of these kids get hurt. There's no doubt.
Now, as far as I know, that the sports-specific training has been a game changer. When I first came through, a lot of the coaches, there wasn't a sports-specific coach at these, in my time, at high school level. And usually at the higher level colleges, there already at that time, there were coaches that were starting to be more specific to training. But what was obvious to me was that if you didn't put the athletes on a very specific training program based not only on their sport, but on their position of their sport, what happened was is you'd end up, you know, getting somebody that was stronger, but usually slower because they weren't training the explosive aspect of that training program. Now, as a doctor, have you seen any difference as far as athletes that are trained with regard to ligament and tendon attachments? Can you tell as opposed to somebody who hasn't trained?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, if you bring up if you're in the right program and your training's for the right sport and you have a trainer that knows what they're doing, you know, you're less prone to have injury. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
But if you're not, and they don't know specifically what they're doing, yeah, you're going to tear something.
And then, more easily. Yeah. And the other thing that I've noticed, again, being a trainer, and I've worked with plenty of athletes and they have their own trainers, but one of the things I learned when I was traveling and over in Bulgaria, they had some very interesting coaches over there, very ahead of their time. And one of the things that they talked about was that stretching was, in their words, stretching was wasted energy. And in some cases, and I've seen this before, there are coaches and trainers that overstretch their athletes, and it seems to actually weaken the ligaments and tendons. Would you agree with that?
I think stretching is important. I mean, there are some people that would say, you know, it's not necessary. But I absolutely think that stretching is important, not just specifically for ligaments and tendons, but for the joints themselves. And otherwise, you know, if you're going to be exercising on a regular basis, depending on what, you know, what protocol you have for what position you're playing or what specific sport you're in, you're going to cause some damage if you don't have the flexibility.
Right. And here's the interesting thing from my perspective now as a bodybuilder. Let me tell you my experience based on what you're saying is when I first went over there, generally in our sport, bodybuilding, what we do is we do a few warm-up sets and then we go into what we call a working set. That's when you actually start your training program. And when the Bulgarians told me this, they said, look, the body becomes its function. This is how your physiology works. If you teach it to stretch, then it needs to stretch because you're teaching it to do that. So they said, conversely, if you teach it to be ready on demand, it will do that too. I was very skeptical about this, you know, but I thought, what the hell? I'm going to go back to the States. And I actually did that. Now they said, you know, over time, you don't want to do this from one, if you're stretching or if you're warming up or stretching, and then you're deciding to be ready on demand, you certainly don't go from stretching to not stretching overnight. It's a gradual transition. So I did that. And I have to tell you that I was able to, over time, lift, and I was ready on demand. I could squat, for example, a 500 or 600 pound squat on my first set, and I could do it as easy as I did before I started when I stretched. So I think, from my own experiences, I thought that that was actually, I was able to do that, and I didn't have any more injuries than I did when I was stretching. Again, I think that what you're saying is true as well, because especially if somebody has like a slight muscle pull, you might want to warm up a little bit to get the blood flowing, and I agree with that. I'm just simply telling you from my own experiences what the Bulgarians said. For me, it actually worked. And they even said that there's less injury when you didn't stretch. So I just found some of the stuff that they were talking about was, I couldn't believe what they were saying. But from my own experiences, it worked for me. So, but there's obviously more than one way to skin the cat. So what about...
It may have something to do with just how much you stretch, you know?
Yeah.
And to what degree you stretch.
Yeah.
Whether you're actually pulling on the ligaments too hard or pulling on the... You know, the tendons too hard before you lift, before you work out.
And I think that's what I probably saw in this example that I'm talking to, because I saw people actually what I thought hyper stretching, you know, too much. And, you know, and it's just like even like when training with a belt or wrist supports, you know, the body is always adapting to that environment. So if you're putting a belt on all the time or always training with wrist straps, that area actually becomes weaker. You know, and so I just kind of thought the same thing when I saw some of these people that were, I think you and I are talking about the same thing. They're just overdoing it, and that has the opposite effect or the consequence for that.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree.
What about spinal surgery? I assume that over years now it's done differently than before. Would you say that's true? And if so, how?
Well, there's a lot of new techniques out there that have been developed. I mean, I think in the old days, not too long ago, spinal surgery, if you had a disc that was herniated and it was pinching a nerve, that you would make an incision and go in and take out that part that was sticking out and remove, get the pressure off the nerve. Which is still, I think, one of the best operations that can be done. There are other ways to do that now. Some of them are just through, you know, small little holes percutaneously. You can do it through a scope. But it may not, you know, so each person has to be weighed differently as to exactly what the procedure would be best for them. But there are minimally invasive back surgeries that can be done, specifically fusions. Do not destroy as much of the architecture that Mother Nature put there. In the old days, we would just make an incision and separate the muscles off the spine and spend hours doing a fusion of some sort, not thinking that there'd be a problem. We would get a beautiful fusion. The bones would be solid, but the patient would still have back pain. And the reason why is because the wound was held open so long, and with retractors, it killed the muscles.
Wow.
So they turned into scar tissue. So they can't work. So they get chronic back pain. So there's been since that's been recognized, there's been a real push to try to do fusions with people that have instability or people that have discogenic pain, where the disc is just painful and they can't function, to do it through minimally invasive procedures.
Sounds like, just like with the knee, it's less invasive in many cases.
Yes, there's a big push to that. And in fact, I saw an article today. There's another push to do some type of an injection in the disc, you know, put in some gel of some sort. I don't think that's been perfected yet, but it may be something in the future that will work. But some of these gels on the market, it's just like there's gels that you inject in the knee that help decrease pain in the knee. Well, you know, even though it's somewhat arthritic, it doesn't cause any more pain, and it delays having to have your knee replaced.
Right.
So there's a push for that again, but I don't think we've reached or gotten an answer for it yet. It hasn't been perfected enough yet.
Yeah. When I hear, again, this may be something my perception of this may be wrong, but because I think you're sort of answering this, but when I hear of somebody getting fused, I think of immediately they're going to have less range of motion. Is that true or not? Or is it like what you said, it's not, if you don't keep the body open and kill that tissue, can you get range of motion again when you fuse somebody?
Well, by the time that you get to the point where you need a fusion, most likely you're probably not having much motion in that vertebral segment to start with, if there's one that's going to be fused, or two or three. Most likely there isn't very much movement. The body is just not going to allow it. But there is going to be more movement, more torque above that level that is fused and below it. So anytime you fuse any joint, it's going to affect the level above or the level below. In other words, if you fuse your elbow, there's going to be some consequences with your wrist or your shoulder. You fuse a segment in your lower back, it's going to affect the one above, or it's going to affect, if you fuse the bottom one, it'll affect the sacroiliac joints. And then you need to look at that to see if those are causing pain. Because there's just too much. You have to look at all these things. And right, there may be misdiagnoses as to why somebody continues to have pain.
Right. Now, do you notice that, I'm assuming that there's a lot of inflammation in the area when somebody's having that kind of pain?
Pardon me?
I'm assuming that when somebody is in that kind of pain, there's a lot of inflammation in the body?
I think so, yeah. I think you have to rule out an inflammatory component to it, not just in general inflammation, but if you can localize where the pain is coming from, figure out where the pain generator is, and perhaps puts some cortisone or injection in there, and you get a good response, then you know that there's an inflammatory component to what's causing their pain.
Yeah, interesting. When you do a surgery, I know, like, I had a couple of my athletes, they were soccer players, and they have quite a few knee injuries just because of the unnatural way to kick the soccer ball. But the people that did the surgeries, these were doctors down in L.A., they had their people literally, after they did the surgery, within hours, they had them already starting to do rehab. Now, when you're doing a spinal like that, do you recommend that too, or is there like a wait period to let things settle?
Well, I when I do a fusion, or what I'll do is, if I just do a routine operation such as a back surgery, take out a disc or trim some bone or something like that, do a laminectomy, a simple procedure, not a fusion, I'll let them rest for a week, and then I'll have them come back to the office, and if their wound is fine, they'll take their stitches out. And then I'll put them on just a walking program. I want them to walk for a month. That's it, up to 2 miles a day. I want them walking. Every step they take, that parespinals will fire on each side. So That'll get those muscles back in shape.
Right.
When they come back in a month, if they haven't done that, then I'll send them to physical therapy and have somebody else help them.
Yeah.
Do that. Or I'll put them in the swimming pool. I'll start them out in aqua therapy.
Yeah. That makes sense. Okay. As an athlete, you know, we're always looking for the competitive edge. I'm going to switch gears here just a little bit. And through better training methodologies, through nutrition, or even performance enhancement drugs. Okay. That's just kind of the mindset of the athlete, especially it seems to me what I've seen over the years is because there's so much pressure, you know, for athletes to play even one sport. I disagree with this, by the way, as a young athlete only playing one sport, but it's gotten so competitive that these coaches are doing one sport year round. And, you know, and then to get a scholarship, I mean, there's just a lot of, it's just, I mean, it's been going on for years, but it just seems like it's more and more all the time. So we're always trying to gain the competitive edge, I guess you might say, because it is a game of inches. So do you think supplements work?
Absolutely.
And how do you know that they do as a doctor? How do you know that?
Well, you know, there's a lot of controversy about that. I mean, you read things in, every day somewhere in the news someplace that, you know, something works better than others. And then the next day you read something that says that there's been a study that says it doesn't work. Well, I think that if applied properly, the appropriate supplements, if they're applied properly, that they do work. And we've done a study in the past in which we took some bodybuilders that had not been on any supplements of any sort, specifically steroids or HGH or any of those things. And we gave them some a cocktail of some supplement that we made. And it was basically a liposomal whey protein. And we tested that against one of the leading proteins on the market at that time, which was very well known. And we had them come to my office. We had them, they were fasting. They hadn't had anything to eat or drink. And we gave them a shake of ours. And then the following day, we did, we kind of reversed the process. We did it over 2 days. And so we had a number of people, 13, I think, or 15 people. And we drew blood from these people once an hour for 8 hours. We took that blood, we spun it down, and we sent it off to a lab, and they did gas spectrophotometry on it, mass spectrophotometry, so they could see exactly what was in the blood, what proteins were in the blood. And with our product, it showed that the protein levels in the blood were being maintained because of the way they were offloaded into the bloodstream over an 8 hour period. In other words, it was a graph that looked like a tabletop, and it was just up all the way across, even, and then down at about 8 hours. Whereas anything else on the market that doesn't have this delivery system is spikes in about 2 hours and it's back down. That's because the body, the enzymes in the gut have hydrolyzed. They've broken it down, but we figured out a way to prevent that. So if you have an athlete then that wants to feed his muscles protein, we give him, I would recommend we give him some of this long acting protein that offloads over 8 hours and their muscles are being fed constantly.
Yeah. That's interesting. You know, that's the, and I know that, you know, we know somebody that does that liposoma therapy and technique, and that's amazing to me because, you know, from my perspective, we've always done a pre and post workout type of protein, and now with this, what you're talking about, you don't really need that. You can take one shake and it lasts 8 hours. What the heck, you know, what a beautiful thing to have that in your system for that length of time, but just doing one shake, right?
That's it. One shake.
So let me ask you this then. And based on that, would you say, or do you recommend, like, the people that are coming in to get surgeries from you, whether it be spinal, hip, or whatever, would you say that it would be a good idea for to put them on a protocol prior to them coming to surgery as far as helping make that surgery turn out better as far as recovery? Is that a good idea?
I think it's a good idea if you're going to do a knee surgery, even if you're going to do a knee replacement, that you send them to physical therapy. You have them, you know, trained on what kind of exercises they're expected to do afterwards. And you try to build up their muscles ahead of time. So it's advisable to send them to physical therapy for a month prior to having have surgery, but even depending on what it is, but usually not a back, but maybe a hip or a knee.
Yeah.
Specifically knees. It's advisable to do that. That way there's not as much of downtime after the surgery.
Yeah. It's kind of like with my pregnant women that come into my facility. I have them train all the way up till, you know, pretty close to the end. And the comeback and the recovery from that is, I mean, at least 50% faster than those that don't do any training. Much better result, you know. So I just kinda, yeah. And even like I'm thinking now, like even like when somebody has a bad knee, for example, and they're coming in to do a surgery, even if, again, this is my opinion as a trainer who's worked with people like this, even if a person couldn't train their knee because it's just too far gone, they could do cross training. In other words, you train other parts of your body and that injured side is going to get some benefit from that. And that's one of the things that I learned is, you know, you can train the other parts and you're still going to get benefits, especially like if somebody's in a cast. It actually minimizes the atrophy a little bit when you cross train, even though they can't move that arm. But you can still train other parts of the body to keep that body. And again, it gets a better result at the end of the day, you know. And I just thought that would be a good thing for, and you're already doing that. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, just generalized training. I mean, it's there is no doubt that the physical exercise is absolutely beneficial.
Yep.
Pre-surgery, post-surgery, and once you establish a habit, then it's probably best that you continue to do that if you can stay in that habit.
Yep.
Going to the gym regularly, doing a little workout at home, some sort, every day.
That is fantastic advice. In fact, I followed your advice. I've been doing it for 38 years. And I just, you know something, I've been that person that's gotten up really early in the morning, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. And I haven't changed, even out though I'm out of the sport, I still do that. You talk about a habit. Well, you know, bodybuilding is one of those sports that makes you crazy anyway, because it demands a lot of discipline. But I totally agree with you. I it's helped me. And I look and I see people that are my age. And like you said, there's no question in my mind that some form of exercise on a regular basis is key. No doubt about
that. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, yeah. And the problem is the general population hadn't figured that out yet.
Amazing. You know, you would think by now we would. Hey, I wanted to ask you, like, with I know that you recommend this protein with this delivery system, but are there any other supplements that you would recommend besides the protein?
Well, besides the protein, just, you know, maintaining the protein for the muscles. I have found, because I have tried it in the past, and that's creatine.
Yeah.
Gives you, and just taking a little dose of creatine, you know, like a half a scoop of the liposomal creatine boosts your energy so much and your strength, probably by, I would think, I felt at least 50% when I tried it. That, excuse me, just a second. Hang on just a second. I'm on a conference call right now. Let me call you back. Okay? Okay, bye. What? Okay, never mind. Sorry.
No problem.
So I think that when I tried it, I think that it gave me a boost. There is no doubt.
Yeah.
Well, probably 50%.
Yeah, and that what I, because I've taken creatine, I still take creatine, and the thing that it that I noticed that it did for me, you know, as you probably know, bodybuilders, you know, our bodies are our labs, and we notice we're very sensitive to anything that we put in our body, you know, good or bad. We have a response, and we're very in tune with our system. One of the things I notice when I take creatine is that it keeps the water in the muscle longer. So when you're hydrated, I think this is what you're saying, it gives you a boost. When you're hydrated compared to dehydrated, you're definitely going to feel a difference in performance. And I think that's what you're saying.
Absolutely. There is no doubt. But with creatine, you have to remain hydrated. It has, because it can affect your kidney. It can create, it can make your creatinine elevated, which is, you don't want to get past 1.2 in that. So, but if you're, you know, you're, most people stay hydrated. I mean, if they're working out, if they're bodybuilders.
Right.
Yeah, except when they're going for competition.
That is true. Like always dehydrated. It's a whole different ballgame. Yeah, a whole different ballgame. Do you think supplements are dangerous?
I think that they're, I don't think they're dangerous. I think that if they're taken properly, but I prefer a supplement that's pure. In other words, it doesn't have all these other things mixed in it that half the time you don't have any idea what it is. And it may affect your blood pressure. It could affect all kinds of things. So I prefer something that's just pure. I mean, if it's whey, nothing else in it. Creatine, nothing else in it. Glutamine, nothing else in it. And if it's taken properly, you'll get the desired effect.
I like your line of thinking, because one of the things I've also learned about the body is your physiology, as you know, is fantastic, and it's always trying to adapt to its environment. But what I've learned is that multitasking, your physiology, even though it will multitask, in other words, break down all these different items that are in the product, because that's what you're saying, it does a better job when it's only concentrating on breaking down one thing. And so I totally agree with what you're saying. In fact, I just bought a product yesterday on the market, and I had an option to buy it was like a olive leaf extract or something like that. And one of the products had not only olive leaf extract, but have all these other things that I had no idea what they really were. But I just used my logic is that, look, my body's going to break down one thing better than it's going to break down several things, and I want to get a better benefit. So I just got the product, which is what you're saying, they had one thing that was pure. I like that strategy.
And well, I think, you know, you go look at these, you go buy some protein, or you go buy something, you know, like a pre-workout, and there's maybe 10 or 15, maybe even more than that, different things in it. You don't know how all that stuff interacts. Right. I mean, one chemical may interact differently with another chemical, and it's all going in your body.
Right.
You may get your blood pressure may go through the roof, and it may affect your thyroid. Who knows what it'll do? Some people really get sick from those things.
Well, and then not only that, you know, people don't realize sometimes. And I'm not saying I'm not, I'm not a person that's done the same thing. But you know, all of a sudden, it's like I got a whole drawer full of supplements. It gets ridiculous. You know, and it's like, wait a minute, I'm supposed to be supplementing with these supplements, not making it, you know, something that's like a meal now, for goodness sake. But I think we just start, and again, I call it SOS, shiny object syndrome. So many people are out there just looking for the next best thing. So like when they see that, it's like, ooh, I'm going to take that one, you know, and the next thing you know, you've got a whole, a drawer full of these supplements that you have no idea, like you said, hell, they could be all counteracting each other in a negative way. And besides that, what I've learned is that a lot of these supplements do not live up to their hype to begin with. So it's expensive urine.
That's true. The body, in many cases, the body only takes what it needs. You know, if you eat three meals a day and you're careful of what you eat and of course, there's so many diets out there now, who knows what it is, but there are diets that bodybuilders have stuck to for years, and they're pretty similar, and they get results with that, but they also manage supplements too sometimes. And I think it's, it's the bodybuilder that does the best keeps it simple.
Yep, you're absolutely right. When I did a video back in the days, because I, in my line of work, one of the things I was known for, I've written a bunch of training courses, but one of the things that I was always known for was talking straight to my clientele. And so we had actually, we shot a video with some top five bodybuilders at that time. And we wanted them to come on the, and we digitized their voice if they wanted us to. But the whole idea behind that was to say, look, why don't you tell the public in this video, because listen, 95 to 99% of the people at that level, these guys were at the Olympia level, the top of the game. They were all taking steroids. And we said, why don't you tell in this video what your regimen is? We weren't doing that to condone the use of it. It was because at the national level, the guys that were coming up, the amateurs that were coming up, as we found out in this video, they were taking so much more of these steroids than the pros were. It was shockingly less the guys were taking. And I think that goes to what you're saying, because it applies to supplementation as well. Would you agree with that?
Sure, absolutely. I agree with that. I mean, the steroids, I know guys that, even to compete right now, they've been taking steroids that are just off the map, and it's affected other parts of their body. And they've been totally concerned about it. And they've had to adjust for that too. So, with they did reach their desired effect from it, but it caused other problems, and which they did not want.
Right. Well, the sport's gotten such to where you're right. I mean, even when I was coming up, it was a lot different in what was going on compared to now. These guys are doing stuff that's pretty scary. They have scary looking bodies, but they're doing some scary stuff with they're doing with their steroid regime. What's your opinion on steroids anyway?
Well, personally, I think to put yourself, you're putting yourself at risk when you're taking, steroids. I mean, it's okay if your body needs them because, you don't have enough of them. It's okay if you need to rebuild a muscle that's been damaged by using HGH or some testosterone or something like that, or anabolic steroid. But in general, I think you should try to achieve the maximum that you can without them. As far as competition is concerned, I think it's not fair in sport, obviously, because the next guy might not take steroids. You're competing against somebody that's got a chemical advantage.
Right.
That's not fair.
No, it's not. And here's what I learned. I completely agree with you. You know, when I wrote my training courses, it was all about, I didn't want to take steroids. It was all about just developing the best training program. And I stood by that until I got to the regional level, because what happens is this, here's the reality of what you're saying, because you're right about that. It's unfair to the person who's trying to do it natural. But here's one of the things I learned in my sport was that even at that level, I was competing in natural events, and guys were what they learned how to do was beat the system. They would come off the steroids, and so there was no testing like they're doing now. There's a natural movement now that's out there in the industry that wasn't out as much when I was competing, So it was never fair to begin with. Even when you're at a natural event, you were competing against guys that were enhanced, So that was, I was conflicted with that, because at some point, I like to compete. And I knew that no matter what, I was competing against guys that were enhanced. And I made the decision, of course, at that point, I was already up to the national level. I made the decision to go ahead and use them. Now, I found out everything that I could about these things so I could make a well decision, at least in my mind. I was well informed so I could make my decision. But you're absolutely right. But what's the guy supposed to do? Not stop training and change the sport, because it's going to be out there no matter what, And I don't know. My opinion was this, I don't think there is, and again, I want to say it again on this camera, I don't condone the use, but at the same time, I don't think that steroids are as dangerous as I don't know if the medical industry makes out to be, or just people in general think they are. I think if they're done in a certain way and you cycle on and off them, I think that the damage is, there's a lot of other things that are out there on the market that are killing people as opposed to steroids. That's just my opinion and my belief. And I use them for 15 years. And, you know, I was tested all the time and no liver damage, no, you know, none of my joints or arteries were plugged up or nothing like that. So, again, I think that with anything else, I think it has to do with the use of them, overuse, and because it's like that with anything. If you do too much of something, you're going to have a negative consequence potentially.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. I think, you know, if you're going to use that and the sport condones it, I guess, then, you know, it has to be monitored. You have to know somebody that knows what they're doing to help you do that. And there are people out there, there are doctors out there that do that.
Yeah.
As long as they're comfortable with it, and you know, you don't get into trouble, hopefully your body will respond appropriately. But everybody's a little different. You may not respond as well as you should, and maybe that's not for you. But yeah, that's something that needs to be monitored.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, I was just curious about what you thought about that. So, listen, let me ask you this now. If you don't mind me asking, are you working out or do you do any kind of a training program consistently?
I haven't done, I'll be honest with you, I have been working out with a trainer for probably the last 8 years on a regular basis, but I haven't in the last, probably the last year, because I had a couple of neck injuries. And so, you know, I know exactly what I'm talking about. I had a couple of neck injuries, I had two neck surgeries, and then I had a back surgery on top of that.
Wow.
So I had two neck surgeries and a back surgery in the last year and a half. So, but I'm just now getting ready to go back to the gym and start over.
Beautiful. Did you do any bodybuilding or powerlifting when you were younger?
No, I really didn't. This is something I got into probably about 10, 15 years ago, just going to the gym. I did do some martial arts and do some Kempo in order to just kind of feel good. I just went to the gym and had a regular workout. You know? Yeah.
Do you go? Were you going like 3 days a week, 5 days a week?
I'm going 3 days a week.
Yeah, that's good. You know, I tell my people in my own facility, because I have training, these personal training studios, and I tell them, look, I'd rather you come in 3 days a week consistently than 5 days a week inconsistently, you know, and because your body will just get a much better response. And I think what happens, you know, a lot of times with individuals, it's human nature, is when they start, they go, you know, balls to the wall, and they don't realize that, you know, if you take that approach, at some point you're going to burn yourself out, you know, and it's just wiser to go in. And I wouldn't do any more than 3 hours a week, but there's other things that you need to do along with training. I'm not telling you something that you don't know. You know, you need to do weight training, you need to do some cardio, and you need to do nutrition, because those are the three components that are definitely responsible for the overall outcome. So
it'll make a huge difference. You know, I think, you know, first of all, you get your nutrition sorted out, what you're going to eat, how much you're going to eat. Get started on your workout program, 10, 15, 20 minutes cardio. Then you start doing some, I'm a diabetic, and they say that diabetics do best with weight resistance. I know that to be true. So weightlifting is really what I like to do. But to get started again, you really should have an experienced trainer,
right,
who is going to know by watching you and what you can do, how much you can do, how much she can push you to the next level.
Yeah.
You shouldn't do it by yourself. You should have a trained professional help you. It may cost a little bit extra money, but it's worth it.
Yeah, I had somebody tell me one time, they said, you know, what you want and what you need are two different things in many cases, you know, and that person was so right. And that's exactly what you're talking about. So, yeah. And, you know, the thing about the industry now, there's a lot of, when I first started, at least in my area, personal training wasn't as popular as it is now. It seems like everybody and their sister and their aunt and their dog are doing personal training to some degree. And I think some of that is because of social media and to be quite honest with you, one of the reasons why I came back out in the industry, because I retired, and even the business, I stopped making developing training courses and all that kind of stuff, and we're back again. But some of the reason why I'm back is because I started seeing some of this information that's on social media, and I was like, I couldn't believe it. I mean, some of these people, I guess it's in every industry, they have just enough information to be very dangerous to the clients that they're working with, you know? So I thought, well, I'm going to do my part and come out, and I'm going to start talking straight again and come out and do these podcasts and with people like yourselves. And because you're the real deal, and more people need to hear this kind of stuff, because they don't, you know, when you're an unsuspecting client, you don't know sometimes how, you know, what kind of environment that your trainer is putting you in.
Well, I think it's also important that if you're going to have a trainer, that you need to pick a trainer, somebody that's probably had some experience in bodybuilding. I mean, whether it be competition or, you know, whether it be, you know, professional or whether it be at least amateur, they should know more than anybody else, because there are trainers that you can go and get, and they may have had a 6 weeks course, and they may have a little certificate that's signed,
yeah,
a 12-week course in how to be a trainer, but they are not, as far as I'm concerned, they don't know. And unless they've been through it themselves, they don't know.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, think of it. If you, as a doctor, did a 6-week course and then you went out and started doing this stuff, I mean, maybe that's a bad example, but it's the same idea, you know? No, for right. Sure. Albert Einstein said it best, and so did my dad. He was smarter than I thought he was, you know? But Albert Einstein says, true knowledge, or real knowledge, is through experience. You got to do this stuff day in and day out and know this stuff to the nth degree. And I know, I can tell by talking to you that you know that. And I'm one of those guys that knows that too. I've learned it from firsthand experience.
Sure.
It makes a huge difference. So anyway, listen, I wanted to, I really thank you for coming on, because I know you're very busy, and I learned something from you today, and I appreciate that. And it was a really interesting interview. So Ian, thank you very much for coming on today.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much, Neil. You're just the consummate host. You're just fabulous.
Thank you, sir. And,
maybe, I hope we can talk again.
Well, I'd like to come visit you in Texas one of these days.
Sure.
You're still living there, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Still okay, here.
Okay, sounds good. Well, thank you again very much for coming on the show.
All right. Enjoyed it. Thank you, sir. Very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.